Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Anyone who was around in the early 1980s and paying close attention to the news may remember those chummy pictures of Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz as he made his way through Washington, shaking hands with then-Secretary of State George Shultz, side-by-side with President Reagan at a White House photo op. In those days, Iran was the enemy, and the regime of Saddam Hussein was, if not a good friend, at least a welcome hedge against its neighbor to the east. Not that there were many illusions about Saddam, who came to power in 1979 and promptly had a number of his closest friends in the Ba'ath Party shot. But in the administration's view, if Saddam was a thug and a bully, at least he was our thug and bully. Even after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait was beaten back by U.S. forces in 1991, there was a point where it seemed Saddam was about to fall in the wake of Shia and Kurdish uprisings. But the United States held back, refusing to provide assistance to dislodge Saddam Hussein from power. Fast forward to today, where U.S. troops, under the command of another president named George Bush, are preparing for what could be the decisive battle for Baghdad. Connection listeners, today we are stepping back and looking at the history of U.S. relations with Iraq. Does the United States bear some responsibility for Saddam's long stay in power? And what lessons should we take from that episode into future adventures in diplomacy? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before we get to our main guest, though, we want to get the latest from Baghdad, from the BBC's Paul Wood, who has been there for weeks now. We spoke just moments ago about how things appear in the city now.
Well, pretty surreal is how I'd sum it up. I've been in the food markets this morning. People were at the pet market buying budgerigars and goldfish for their children, buying television aerials to receive a much depleted signal from Iraqi state television. You could buy bananas from Jordan, brought along the road from Jordan, still apparently open. But of course, they have also been told by the Iraqi leadership that this city will be encircled within the week. And we hear the first sounds from the military command in Qatar that American troops now are at the airport. Some colleagues of mine have just come back from the airport and they say they see no sign of American troops, but that doesn't mean that special forces are not dug in there somewhere. And we hear from colleagues with the U.S. Forces that the battle for the airport is expected to begin tomorrow.
Is there anything that you can see from where you are in terms of columns of smoke on the horizon or anything that gives you any indication of where the troops might be?
Well, there are always columns of smoke on the horizon in Baghdad, and that is a defensive measure carried out by the Iraqis. They fill trenches around the capital with oil, they put firewood on it, and they set it alight to try and create a dark curtain across the horizon to confuse incoming jets looking for so-called targets of opportunity, that is, Iraqi troops unlucky enough to be caught out in the open. We have had, as we always have, intermittent bombing here. What we do not have is any confirmation whatsoever of a battle on the outskirts of Baghdad. That could be because people are not coming back with news of that, they're not going close to it. Or I think more likely that if there are engagements, they are very small engagements. This is not a noose tightening around Baghdad. There are two prongs, the points of two spears, advancing through Kut to the east and through Karbala to the west. And I think it's probably true to say the battle for Baghdad has not begun yet. The forces are moving into position for it.
So nothing that you can see yet. What do you expect to be able to see and hear from where you are once that battle begins?
In the city itself, and this is why I call the atmosphere a little surreal, there are no big defensive positions. There are a few sandbags on street corners, put there, I think, as much for morale as for anything else. There are no big tank traps, as you might see in other cities expecting this kind of assault. There are no huge sandbagged emplacements for guns. And I think that's a reflection of Allied air superiority, because if you can see it, you can kill it. And there are two strategies open to the Iraqi troops. One is to withdraw back into Baghdad, literally melt away and present an invisible target to the coalition, daring American and British soldiers to come in after them with, I think, what would be terrible loss of civilian life and perhaps of the lives of American and British soldiers. The other strategy, and this might be a worry for Allied commanders, is that somewhere out there, there is waiting and hiding a substantial force of Iraqi soldiers. President Saddam Hussein has said he's only committed a third of his army. Where are those troops and what are they doing? Nobody knows.
And no sign of them, apparently.
Well, no sign of them. I think what has happened over the past couple of weeks, and I've driven down the Euphrates River Valley and seen it myself, is that the Iraqi troops have spread themselves out. They've taken the lessons of the Kosovo air campaign, when you might remember the inflated claims we had from the American and British militaries about 100 tanks being destroyed. In the end, it was 13 were actually destroyed in Kosovo. And they've realized you simply have to hide. And they've been hiding in the crops, in the orchards, in the towns and the villages along the Euphrates River Valley. The question is, are they going to regroup? And if they regroup, are they going to come back into Baghdad? Or are they going to try and strike at what is the elongated tail of this very rapid advance from Kuwait, a tail which stretches back several hundred miles and which, as we've seen with the taking of American prisoners of war, can be very vulnerable?
Do you get any sense, as you say, it seems surreal, people seem to be going about their business, are they stocking up for what they believe is about to be visited upon them, or are they perhaps believing what they've been told, that the troops aren't close by?
Well, the Iraqi information minister said today that the nearest American soldier was 100 miles away. That doesn't mean that people don't think the troops are coming, because the Iraqi leadership has been preparing them for it. People have been warned they're about to be encircled, and within the week. There has been given out here 2 to 6 months' worth of flour. People have been buying extra supplies in the market. Prices certainly have gone up many fold, but there is still food in the marketplaces to buy. When the war started, I saw panic buying of large plastic sacks used to store water. People have been digging wells in the garden. I think they have enough food supplies for a reasonably long siege. There is, though, if you scratch the surface, a terrible fear about how that siege might be conducted. And remember, people get their news largely from Iraqi state television. They listen to the BBC in Arabic. They occasionally tune in to the CNN radio or BBC in English. But largely they get their news from Iraqi television. I was talking to a Baghdad housewife in western Baghdad near the airport this afternoon, and she was telling me, well, in Basra, the British soldiers were killing women and children in their houses. You and I know what the real position is, but that's what she believes from Iraqi television. And she asked me, is this what's going to happen here? So the American soldiers who think they're going to be welcomed as liberators will find a population which is terrified of what is going to happen, and which is listening to the Iraqi leadership when they say this is a fight for your lives, this is a fight for your homes and your families.
Paul, we thank you so much for giving us the update, and we send you our very best wishes to stay safe in the midst of it.
Thank you.
Again, that was the BBC's Paul Wood on the line from Baghdad. Joining me now in the conversation today from the NPR studio in Washington is Judith Yaffe. Judith is Middle East Project Director at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington. Previously, she was Senior Intelligence Officer in the CIA for 20 years in the Office of Near Eastern and South Asian Analysis. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And also, Robin Wright is joining us. She is diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and has covered the Middle East for most of the past 30 years. She is additionally the author of Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. Hello, Robin.
Good morning.
Delighted to have both of you with us. And I want to ask each of you, as you survey the events of the past 14 days, are you surprised that it has come to this? Robin, maybe you want to go first.
Surprised that we were in a war? Not particularly. This has been brewing really since the end of the 1991 Operation Desert Storm. There's been always this tension that's existed over, you know, what do you do about Saddam Hussein when he doesn't comply with UN arms inspections? I think the events of 9/11 led to a greater concern in Washington about the kinds of threats the United States and its allies might face, and it looked at Iraq as, you know, one of those that might present the post-Al-Qaeda, post-Afghanistan threat. So I'm not surprised that it's ended up this way. I think that it's been long coming.
And Judith?
Well, I'd have to say I'm not surprised by different things from Robin. I'm not surprised that it was not a cakewalk. I'm not surprised that we haven't been welcomed as liberators, although hopefully at some point we will be. And I'm not surprised that we haven't seen massive surrenders of military units throwing down their arms and coming over to us.
Because?
Because I don't think we should have expected that. I think we underestimated Iraqis' loyalty to the state, to nationalism, their opposition to foreign occupation. This is not saying they're loyal to Saddam. This says that they see themselves as the Iraqis and as a state, and they've never liked foreign occupation, not now, not in history. And I think we underestimated the fear factor. You can say that Saddam's no longer in power, but if I were an Iraqi, unless I saw him in the streets, I wouldn't believe it. There are too many people watching Iraqis. We've heard about the Saddam Fedayeen. If you don't do what you're supposed to do, we will shoot you in the back. And I think that a lot of Iraqis are well aware of how they need to behave to keep safe.
Well, in fact, we saw that story from almost the first moment when Saddam Hussein came to power. Let's start the clock in the big picture at 1979. Tell us the story, Robin, about that first meeting of the Ba'ath Party. Very dramatic moment. There are videotapes of what happened there.
Well, I defer to Judith on this one. She is the world's expert, or America's expert, on this early rise to power.
Judith?
Well, he actually came to power 1968. He was number two. By 1979, he had consolidated his power. He calls a meeting of 250 or more of the senior Ba'ath Party bureaucrats, military, people that had been with him for years. And in that room, he announces he's now taking over the presidency because his cousin, Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr, is very ill. And then he proceeds to read from a list of about 60 people who are plotting to betray him to the Syrians. And as he calls out their names, some rise up in protest, but they're all taken from the room and they're killed. And the executions are carried out by other loyalists in the room. And the funny thing about it's not funny, but in the tape you can see some of the people weeping in fear and in relief that their name hasn't been called. And Saddam is up there smoking a huge Havana cigar, and he wipes tears away from his eyes, but he's laughing too.
What did Western intelligence know about that meeting, or did it at the time?
We saw the tapes not long thereafter, because not only did the Iraqis tape it, they sent the tapes around as a form of intimidation and warning. We're in charge. We're in power. I'm in power. And this is what might happen to you if you are not loyal. So I think that the message was fairly clear. And copies of those tapes were gotten out of Iraq.
Robin, was that the point at which you began to form an opinion about what kind of man we were dealing with here, or did that come later?
Well, I think he had been an emerging power for a decade, and he was well known as the power behind the regime in Baghdad. I think it was also very clear, because remember, 1979 was the same year as the Iranian Revolution, and not long after, within a year, Saddam Hussein exercised his sense of power and went after the Iranians, thinking that he could take this long-standing conflict with a neighboring country over a strategic waterway and check both the political movement, the new political movement that Iran represented, and at the same time make some territorial gains for Iraq, which he did initially in the war.
Robin, I have to stop you there. We need to take a break. Connection listeners, in looking at the history of U.S. and Iraqi relations, do you think that this war with Iraq was inevitable? And do you think that the United States bears some of the responsibility for Saddam Hussein's rise and stay in power? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about relations between the United States and Iraq, starting from President Saddam Hussein's rise to power in 1979. Connection listeners, looking back at the history of the two countries, do you think this war with Iraq was inevitable? What kind of foreign policy lessons can the United States learn from its past with Iraq, as its own troops now make their way toward Baghdad? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us at this hour is Judith Yaffe. She is currently the Middle East Project Director of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Prior to that, she was Senior Intelligence Officer in the CIA for 20 years, focusing her research on Iraq. And also joining us is Robin Wright. She is the diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times and author of Sacred Rage, The Wrath of Militant Islam. Robin, maybe we need to pick up with you. You were telling us a little bit about how you formulated your opinions about Saddam Hussein, and I want to ask you, let's pick up the story with the Iran-Iraq War, which went on for 8 bloody years, back and forth. Fill us in on what the position of the Reagan administration was during that time.
Well, the relations did not exist in the early 1980s between, Iraq and the United States. Because Iraq had broken off relations with the United States because of our support for Israel, dating back decades. As the war with Iran progressed, there was a growing fear that Iran actually might make some headway. And so by the mid-1980s, you saw the Reagan administration reaching out to the Iraqis. The old adage is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and since Iran was our enemy, that meant Iraq could be our friend. And there were emissaries sent by the Reagan administration, including the current Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, to Baghdad to talk about cooperation. This was despite the fact that at the same time, Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran. In 1983, 84, 85, 86, UN teams went over and verified the use by Saddam against Iran. But at the time, there was not an outcry. In large part, again, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the administration in 1986 made a very important decision about actually assisting the Iraqis against Iran as Iran began to gain some territory and look like it might even be able to win the war. And the Reagan administration provided satellite intelligence of where Iranian troops were deployed. It also helped train Iraqi troops in for a strategic offensive in the south, in the Fal Peninsula, and made a very important decision that it would provide not only a training but a kind of mock run of how this offensive would play out, provided the satellite intelligence for it. And this was an offensive that the Iraqis used chemical weapons.
Judith, let me ask you to jump in here and give us the situation from your perspective. You were there at the CIA analyzing all of this. What was your take on it at the time?
Well, I always looked at it as being good news and bad news. Bad news that we were providing this kind of assistance to Saddam. But the good news always seemed to me, in a way, that the Iraqis didn't really listen much to us. I think they learned more about how we were able to provide this kind of information, the methods we use, than they actually did in listening and following, in terms of what we said. Again, I would underscore something Robin said. Not only did we not say anything about Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iran, we didn't say anything when the Anfal occurred in 87 and 1988 against the Kurds, including the event at Halabja. Very little was said at all, and not just by the United States, but by the West in general. Very little mention was made at the time.
Give us a line or two more about the attack on Halabja, because that was clearly a big marker.
Halabja was part of a series of attacks which are called the Anfal. It was a series of operations by Baghdad against the Kurds in the north along the Iranian border. The ostensible reason was that the Kurds were giving safe haven, refuge, if not outright supporting Iranians who were running through the area, the Iranian Rev Guard. Now, it is true that there was an Iranian military presence from time to time going through there. And it's also true that the Kurds were not fond of Saddam then, and that there was opposition to his regime, which came out of the region. But they decided to send a message very clearly. This is what happens to people who are not loyal. Halabja was one village. They killed 5,000 people. The pictures have been shown over and over again. It's a town, I think, of 60,000. But there were other villages that were decimated as well. At Saddam's order and carried out by his cousin, who earned the name Chemical Ollie for his role in carrying out this campaign.
And then that brings us to the crucial question of after the first Gulf War, why did the United States allow Saddam Hussein to remain in power? It looked as if at one moment that he was going to fall on his own. Robin?
You're talking about 1991?
1991. We're sort of fast-forwarding through history here, unfortunately, because there's so much to cover.
No. Go ahead.
Well, in 1991, remember that the mandate was only from the United Nations to liberate Kuwait. It was never to topple the regime. And from the very beginning, there was this inherent contradiction because first the Bush administration, then the Clinton administration believed that you weren't going to get cooperation from Saddam, that it would actually take his downfall. Now, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, counted on the fact that after this devastating military defeat, that Iraqis would rise up and topple him, or that the military, humiliated by the loss, might remove him and you know, replace him with another Ba'athist Party leader. Neither happened. And the United States couldn't do more because the UN mandate was limited. And at the time, the American will to go in because of the potential casualties, the international support just wasn't there for the kind of operation you see today.
Yeah, all those things that Robin says are true. But I would underscore the fact that there was an assumption made by the first Bush administration. How could he survive? Who survives the loss of two wars? Because the Iraqis didn't really win the war against Iran and such devastation. But that was an assumption. It was based on more on faith, I think, than on a candid assessment of Saddam's strengths and his ability to survive.
And wasn't there I guess you could describe it as a fatal miscalculation at one point in the meeting in the tents in the desert after the fighting had stopped, when U.S. forces said graciously to the Iraqis that, yes, you can keep your helicopters, and didn't remember to mention, apparently, that, you know, they shouldn't be armed, because aren't those the helicopters they used to put down these uprisings?
Yeah, those were helicopter gunships. Probably there were two errors there. One was Schwarzkopf's, but one wasn't. He really didn't have instructions on how to write what kind of terms for the ceasefire, and that was an administration failing. But having said that, helicopters, maybe he was thinking in terms of the Civil War when Grant agreed with Lee that the soldiers should be allowed to take their horses and mules and go home. I don't know why he allowed that, but it was clearly a serious mistake because they used those helicopter gunships to suppress the rebellion in the south against the Shia, killing as many as maybe 60,000 to 80,000 people in the process.
Robin,
that's also, we can go back to what Judith said earlier, that's also one of the reasons that you see the kind of reaction you do today in South Iraq, that people are very sore about what happened in 1991. They don't trust the Americans to follow through. There is fear that they are going to be abandoned again. Not until the liberation of Baghdad are you likely to see any kind of stronger reaction, when there is a guarantee that Saddam Hussein is actually gone.
We're talking this hour about whether the United States bears any responsibility for the regime of Saddam Hussein. You can become part of the conversation by calling us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have John on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What would you like to know?
Well, first of all, I want to say that in answer to your question, I think we do have some responsibility for Saddam Hussein and his continuing reign of terror and rise to power. And the other thing is, I just wonder if we can't look at the fundamental issue of the fact that over the years, over many years, we've supported a number of dictators in countries that have ultimately turned against us. And it seems to me that this sort of pragmatic diplomacy and shoring up dictators and then ultimately having their people turn against us is a lesson that we haven't incorporated into our foreign policy. And I'd like to know what your guests think about that notion of being less pragmatic and being more direct and being more clear about what our diplomatic, what our ethical goals are in terms of diplomacy.
Thanks, John. Let me throw that one to Judith first, because presumably this has been the topic of many, many, many conversations that you've had over the years.
Oh, yes. Well, it's a I teach as well, and it's a question I'm always asked. And the caller is right. What can I say? We don't do our foreign policy based, for the most part, on high principles of what is coherent, consistent, and in line with our democratic principles. We usually make foreign policy for very practical, pragmatic reasons. Is it about oil? Is it about terror? Is it about weapons of mass destruction? Is it about the Cold War? Is it about the issues that were involved then? I cannot defend this. I think his question is an important one. But the reality is that foreign policy and these decisions are made by people who are not scholars or necessarily interested in the coherence or the rightness of these policies. They make them for other reasons.
Well, and also making them in the heat of the moment. John, I want to go back to you for a second and ask, if you don't take a pragmatic approach, then what approach do you take and how do you know it's the right one at the time?
Well, I think Stevie Wonder could have seen that Saddam was not a good guy. I mean, it's not like I'm not necessarily a scholar either. I'm just saying that we look at these sort of short-term, sort of almost tactical goals of, okay, he's the enemy of my enemy and therefore my friend, knowing full well that he's not a good person. This was not somebody who was going to necessarily run his country in a way that ultimately the people who live in it are going to say, yeah, great, he's a great guy, we love him.
Robin?
Yeah, let me add one point. I think one of the great challenges that the United States will face in the aftermath of Iraq is dealing with some of our allies, notably countries like Saudi Arabia. In the, you know, since the demise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia arguably, perhaps along with North Korea, but anyway, has one of the worst human rights records in the world, and yet it is one of our closest allies, a pillar of our foreign policy in the region and a country that we will deploy troops to defend. This is, you know, a question that's not just an issue of the past, but is perhaps the most important challenge we face in the next decade.
Thanks for the call, John. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, you certainly are invited to do so. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And now we go to Chum Ki from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Chum Ki.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would like your guests to actually go back just a little bit and talk about the coup in Iraq engineered by the United States of a democratically elected government there in the 50s. And then I submit to you that the goal, pragmatic it may be, has never been democracy in Iraq, but simply to use it as and when the United States has chosen to do so, which is why I think people are around the world so deeply suspicious of this, you know, sort of lofty talk about Iraqi freedom, we are going to liberate Baghdad and so on, that I don't see why we should even stop to take that seriously for a second.
Thanks so much for the question and the comment, Chum Ki. Judith, I know this preceded your time in the CIA, but my guess is you know a lot about what happened in the 50s and also in 1963.
History is everything. Well, she was saying something about a democratically elected government. Did she mean in the 1950s? There's never been a democratically elected government in Iraq. There have been elections, almost always have been rigged, including by the British when they brought King Faisal in 1920. But democratically elected, I don't know. There also are a lot of stories out there, and from a region that loves conspiracies, about how the U.S. engineered coups. She may mean the 63 coup when the Ba'athists came in briefly. I don't know. She may mean the 68 coup when they came in again. Again, I don't know. I guess the answer would be this. On the one hand, I don't think we engineered any coups there. I'd be very surprised if we did. We just weren't that good at it. So I think you would have seen fingerprints a long time ago. I've only heard people claiming to know, but never any proof. But I think the other point is that if we didn't know what was going on under Iraq, under any regime, and in this sense I'm saying there's a reason you have an intelligence organization, and that's to find out what's going on in places that you can't get in and observe easily, that are not transparent society. So in a way, I would hope we knew what was going on there. I'm not sure that we did, but I don't think that we engineered any coups. Sorry.
Judith, was this a time when the United States was more inclined to be interventionist pre-Vietnam?
Well, it's the Cold War mentality, and there was interventionism, there's no question. But the interventionism had a lot to do with whose side are you on, Moscow or ours? Whose side in the Cold War? We didn't like the, for example, the Iraqi Communist Party, but I'm not convinced that meant that we liked the Baathists much better. But, you know, the Cold War ideology was a very strict one. You were on our side or their side, and we were doing a lot to try to manipulate governments and elections, basically in Europe, where if you look at what happened in Italy and in other countries after the war, that there it was much clearer what was going on.
Although those lines seem to be redrawn now, only it's terrorism instead of Cold War that's drawing them, right?
Yes.
Let's take another call. Neil is in Boston. Hi, Neil.
Yes. I've heard it said that it wasn't necessarily stupidity on General Schwarzkopf's part, but that he was ordered to do what he did, that we wish to keep Saddam in power as a counterforce against Iran, which, after all, was our biggest enemy, especially after the 1980 hostage situation. Is that just a conspiracy theory, or is there anything to it?
Robin, let's throw that one to you.
I'm not sure that our goal really was to try to keep Iraq as a counterforce to Iran. I think the United States did want to prevent the breakup of Iraq into three different parts. That was one of the great debates back then. Was there a danger in the aftermath, particularly with the uprisings, the Kurds in the north, the Shiites in the south, that there would be the kind of disintegration of Iraq in a way along ethnic and religious lines that would have a tremendous spillover impact on all of our allies in the region as well as Iran? And that was perhaps a consideration. I know that there are a lot of conspiratorial theorists who believe that we actually wanted Saddam Hussein to remain in power back then.
All right. Connection listeners, we are discussing the history of relations between the United States and Iraq this hour. Do you think the U.S. bears some of the responsibility for the length of his time remaining there? And does your understanding of the war change when you take a step back from the current events and look at the present situation in a more historical context? We'd like you to be part of the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, the history of the United States and Iraq. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're taking a step back, away from the current events of the war this hour, and looking at the history of relations between the United States and Iraq. To join in the conversation, call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And, Judith, I want to get into the matter of, as we're sort of doing the roller coaster ride of history here, the 12 years after Gulf One, which were basically Saddam Hussein thumbing his nose at the UN weapons inspection teams. I'm wondering, why did he think he could get away with that, and why did he get away with it for as long as he did?
Well, he didn't exactly always thumb his nose. Remember, inspections went on from 1990. I think they started, late 91, 92, until 1997. In which there were a lot of inspections. A lot of things were found. We found elements of their nuclear programs, four different ways to build the bomb. A lot of chemical stuff. The Iraqis never admitted they had biological weapons and were experimenting until 1995 when Saddam's son-in-law defected. And we never did find those elements, but there were inspections, and they found a lot of things, but inspections aren't a magic bullet. They don't find everything. They don't always come up a success. And Saddam would balk from time to time. Now, in the earlier period, when he would balk or he would not cooperate, he was declared to be in material breach, which authorized then military what, punishment operations, if you will. But as we got into the later 90s, not only did he cooperate less with inspections and refuse sites, he was doing a lot of other things to test coalition U.S. will. If I'm going to overfly the no-fly zones, which we know he did a lot of. And when we didn't react, he did it again, and he would do more. Saddam only reacts or retreats in the face of the credible and willing use of force. Short of that, he thinks he's got time to play around. Coalitions don't mean anything. UN and the permanent members of the council are falling among themselves. Sanctions were weakening. Nobody wanted to abide by them. That, you know, he didn't like waiting that long, but he did believe that things were coming around in his direction.
And assume that at some point people would just get bored with it and stop paying
attention?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Which in some cases was happening.
Robin, in those early years after Gulf One, do you see that as a time when he was perhaps consolidating his power again and was more inclined to do what he was supposed to?
Well, there were great pressures on him. And remember, the coalition was still kind of united at that point. He tried repeatedly to cheat and retreat and to feel how much he could get away with. He reconsolidated what he had, even though his army today or on the eve of the war was still only a third of what it was before he invaded Kuwait. But the key element in all of this is not just Saddam Hussein. It was that, you know, in the post-Cold War world, the barometer of power was not just military might. It was increasingly economic strength. And a lot of countries, Russia, China, France, three key members of the Security Council, all had, you know, strong economic relations with Iraq. Russia was owed a lot of money. There was a real interest in seeing Iraq come back on the marketplace. And the pressures politically by the international community were to try to get some kind of agreement on disarmament and end sanctions and bring back the regime. They were willing to accept Saddam Hussein, and that's where this policy clash began. The United States wanted to get rid of him, and the rest of the world never agreed with that. And that was been true right up until the eve of the war. So it was a lot of outside factors beyond Saddam Hussein that contributed to his ability to stall for 12 years.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Paul has been standing by from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hello, Paul.
Yes, hello. I wanted to go back to an earlier point. A caller raised the question of our supporting dictatorships when it's pragmatically convenient to do so. And that's a reasonable thing for a country to do. But my question is, why is it that when we then go into the attack mode that we're currently in, the discourse gets turned into a moral discourse, and then suddenly a dictator who might have been pragmatically convenient to support before now suddenly is an absolute evil. We're on the side of good. And the general population gets caught up in this moral discourse. And then anybody that tries to dissent within is then branded as wanting to support an immoral cause.
Interesting question, Paul. Let's see what Judith's take is on that.
Well, I agree with you, and I think you're asking the wrong people that question. You need to direct that to the Bush administration and more directly to the advisors he has, which have favored the war. I can't answer that question. I wish I could.
Robin, you want to take a run at it?
Well, I think George Bush probably added a dimension that didn't exist in either the administration of his father or the Clinton administration, and that is the issue of morality, looking at the whole issue of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction from the prism of good versus evil, whereas the rest of the world has been much more pragmatic in looking at the political and economic realities of Iraq's geostrategic importance. It's a very important question.
Robin, and thanks for the call, Paul. Robin and Judith, let's turn again to what happened immediately after Gulf One in terms of this side of the ocean at the Pentagon when there was concern about the sort of ragged ending to the war. There was a group of neoconservatives headed by Paul Wolfowitz at the Pentagon who began putting together a policy about the use of American power in general and specifically aimed at the removal of people like Saddam Hussein. It was sort of a replay of the old Teddy Roosevelt line about speak softly and carry a big stick, except with the added, and be ready to use it. and don't be afraid to use it. And there things sort of sat until George W. Bush began running for president. And then post-September 11th, it seemed to reappear. And now there was the threat of terrorism that seemed to make it even more urgent. And I'm wondering, was this a policy waiting for an event to bring it to life?
I think the answer is yes and no. If you go back to the time right after 1991 and you look at Paul Wolfowitz and Colin Powell and a lot of other people who are in power now and who have, well, with the exception of Colin Powell, very strongly pro-war. But if you go back to 1991, they were not in favor of continuing a U.S. presence in Iraq at the end of the war. They were all for getting out as soon as possible. Colin Powell didn't want to keep the troops there. Neither did Paul Wolfowitz or many of the others. His conversion to a war is the only solution. You have to ask him when that exact turn comes. But many of the neocons who are so strongly in favor of war, as they became in the later, mid to late 1990s, were not there in 1991. They fully wanted to get out, and they thought that it would someone would take care of it for them. Now, I also have a feeling that the very conservative advisors in the Bush administration were pretty much intent on doing Iraq, although they were kind of discreet during the campaign. But I think that was on their agenda from the time they came into office. 9/11 gave them, gave them the excuse or gave them the legitimization, as they saw it, to do it, because they were absolutely convinced that Iraq had to be involved in that. And even if he wasn't, this was there was sufficient reason to put him near the top of the list as to the evils we needed to deal with.
There was also something bigger at play during this period, and that is with 9/11, the whole idea of preemptive strikes, that we weren't going to allow this to happen to us again because we were going to eliminate the threats before they actually came to our shores. And that's really what's playing out today, the embrace by the administration of the idea of preemptive strikes, going to war with another country before they provide either the weaponry for others to attack us or become a threat themselves. And the whole idea of using this power we have since the end of the Cold War, unchallenged power, to protect ourselves and also, as President Bush believes, to do good.
Actually, Robin, as you say, that was a policy which was articulated very clearly by President George W. Bush in his State of the Union address in January of 2002.
I will not wait on events while dangers gather. I will not stand by as peril draws closer and closer. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons.
So this clearly seemed a shift in policy, right? Not just we're going to defend ourselves, but if necessary, we're going to have to take action.
This is an enormous shift in U.S. policy since we became a superpower after World War II. And it'll be very interesting to see if this is going to be accepted as the basis of U.S. foreign policy by the next administration, by the rest of the world, whether this is a one-shot deal or whether this is, you know, the trend in the 21st century.
Judith, what would you say to that?
I would say this. It's not a wholly new idea. If you go back to the 1980s when the intelligence community set up what became known as the Counterintelligence Center, Bill Casey's idea was that this would be proactive, that no longer would the U.S. simply react to events that threatened us, but we were going to be proactive. Now, it's one thing to do that as a, you know, intelligence, to try to foil terrorist operations, which clearly we've never been able to, you know, perfect. But to translate that into, I'm not saying there's a direct line, but I guess in my own little mind there is, that doesn't make a foreign policy. That's nice to do operationally for, you know, limited issues, but to make that as your defense and security strategy is a whole new issue, as Robin points out.
Judith, you're a teacher. I'm wondering, in the few minutes that we have left, what should we learn here about what U.S. policy should be going forward?
Well, I guess I'm of two minds. I hate war, but I really do support the military effort here because there's no other way we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And again, it's one thing to know war and to understand foreign policy and the history of this, but the other thing is I've done Iraq for too long. And 30 years of looking at this has told me how much damage, how destructive, you know, how evil that regime is. And I'm not even thinking about, because I didn't buy into the support for al-Qaeda, and I still don't. But the weapons of mass destruction, the evil, the destruction he's wrought on his society, that makes it very difficult for me to say, boy, the war was wrong. I think you do have some very important questions. Why now? What were the reasons? Those are issues that are going to be asked, I think, discussed for a long time. But as I say, from my perspective of having followed the Iraqi side of it, it is hard to say that we shouldn't have done anything about him.
Robin, I want to hear from you on this as well, and whether you see this as a confluence of events that in some way were inevitable, or was this unfinished business that had to be taken care of?
It was probably both. It was unfinished business because Saddam had not complied with a slew of UN resolutions about disarming, but it also was a confluence of events. I think without 9/11 this would not have happened. But I think the bigger lesson out of this really is, and how history will judge us, is not as much on the war itself, but what we put in its place. The idea of preemptively striking will only be accepted if we can create something that is better, and if we really do trigger what's commonly known now as the democratic domino theory. I think it's going to be very tricky for us to put in place a good democracy anytime soon in Iraq, or see that then spread to other democracies. Clearly, it's going to be a catalyst for change. The big question is, what kind of change? If we don't do it right after the war, the danger is we set in motion another series of historical events that threaten us even more than Saddam Hussein did, by the anger in the Islamic world, by being seen to put in place perhaps people who reflect our will more than the will of the Iraqi people. There are more dangers in the aftermath of this war, arguably, than it even going into it.
Robin, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much for being with us. My guests have been Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for the LA Times, and Judith Yaffe, Middle East Project Director for the Institute of National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University in Washington. Earlier we heard from Paul Wood, the BBC's man in Baghdad. To continue the conversation, you can go to our website, www.theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.